This is study number 4 in the book of Ecclesiastes. We've reached chapter 7 in the book, and I'll ask you to turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. This is approximately halfway through this book. In the first section of this book, Solomon has noticed many instances of vanity in life. And having pronounced his conclusion, all is vanity and vexation of spirit, he now begins to give some practical counsels as he carries on observing things in this life. He gives some practical counsels in order that we may alleviate to some extent that vanity, in order that life may be made bearable. He begins now to give proverbs, practical counsels, so that this may be so. It's significant that if you look up the word vanity as it occurs in the book of Ecclesiastes, when you get to this second half of the book, the number of occurrences drop to half what they were in the first half. And I think you'll realise that this book is, to some extent, a miserable book. I believe it's intended to be. I believe it's intended to point us to Christ from that point of view, to turn us away from the vanity of this life, and to turn us to him. Now in the second half of this book, things somehow begin to cheer up, and we get these practical counsels that this man is giving, so that we might live in this life. We mustn't read into Ecclesiastes what was later on revealed in the New Testament. We must remember that this book is an unfolding revelation. And so we must look at it in that particular sense. Now Solomon's conclusion has been this, that all is vanity. A word which doesn't mean so much empty, but means that everything is transitory, everything is passing away, everything is temporal, nothing permanent. And as a result of this, there is no profit when we have done all. There is no profit over and above. And Solomon looks round upon life and he sees this, what he calls sore travail, that God has given to man to be exercised by. And it's quite natural then that when he begins chapter 7 and he begins to give these practical counsels, that he starts at this point. He starts at the point where he looks at sorrow, the sorrow which comes from a recognition of the true nature of this life apart from God. And he begins with this sorrow and he shows that sorrow and death, there is a benefit to be gained from these things. We must remember, of course, that we're dealing with a God whom we read is able to make all things, whether they are good things or evil things, to make them work together for good to them that love God and are the called according to his purposes. And so even this sorrow he looks upon as being better than something else, than laughter. Sorrow is better than laughter. And so in chapter 7, verses 1 to 6, he begins to lay out before us the benefits of sorrow contrasted with laughter. Now let's look at this contrast. Let's read these verses. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. The connection here is that at the day of death a man has made a good name for himself, at least he should have done. At the day of his birth, he has no name. He's a nobody. But at the day of his death, a good name. And it's far better on the day of his death that he should have a good name than that he should be anointed with some precious ointment for his burying. And so he goes on then to consider this idea of death and sorrow. And he says in verse 2, it's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. And now he's beginning to contrast this sorrow. You'll note that he does not contrast it with joy. He contrasts it with a kind of shallow laughter. He calls it later on the laughter of fools. This is not sorrow over against joy. He's not saying that sorrow is better than joy. We know it isn't. Sorrow is better than laughter. Let's see his contrast here in verse 2. He contrasts the house of mourning with the house of feasting. Well, Solomon knew all about the house of feasting. The wine flowed freely. There was plenty of raucous laughter and plenty of the song of the fools in the house of feasting. In verse 3, sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. But this is a shallow kind of laughter, because in verse 6, he says, as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This is vanity. In verse 4, he contrasts this with the house of mirth. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. The heart of fools is in the house of mirth. And then in verse 5, it is better to hear the rebuke of the wise, better to get told off about something, than for a man to hear the song of fools. So he's contrasting this sorrow with a kind of shallow laughter that the world looks to in order that it might forget its troubles. Feasting, rioting, the singing of bawdry songs, and so on. These kind of things are what the world looks for. But here it is, sorrow is better than these things. You might look at verse 6, the contrast that he makes, or rather the comparison. As the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of a fool. The idea here is of a man putting these thorns under a pot with water in, and he's trying to boil the water, but he can't do it because when you light these thorns, they burn up quickly, and they've gone in a moment. That's what the laughter of fools is like. You know, Sir Winston Churchill once quoted this verse in the House of Commons when certain people were laughing rather foolishly at him. He said, "Your laughter reminds me of the crackling of thorns under a pot." And you know, most of them didn't realize what he was referring to, but he was referring to this passage. It says the laughter of a fool. So he knew his Bible all right, and he knew this passage. But there it is. It burns up quickly, and it's gone in a moment. That's the laughter of a fool. If we want a contrast between sorrow and joy, we have it in the Lord Jesus Christ. We read of Christ that he was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And yet, for the joy that was set before him, you see the two come together in the Lord Jesus Christ, and they should come together to some degree in us. Sorrow may be our lot, but joy may be always a constant inward experience. The place of joy is found in verse 14 of this chapter. In the day of prosperity, says Solomon, be joyful. Oh, don't be miserable in that day. Be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider, think. God has put the two over against the other in order that man may have a balanced life. And that's what he's going to say in these next verses. A balanced life is the great key to life here. There's a place for laughter, of course. Not the shallow laughter of fools, but there can be a healthy laughter. We're not condemning laughter. In chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes, when he's talking about the seasonal nature of things, he says in verse 4 that there is a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. But it's a seasonal thing. There is a time for it. The Apostle Paul said very much a similar thing. If you turn to Romans chapter 12, Romans chapter 12. Although, of course, the Apostle Paul had a great deal more life, I believe, than this man Solomon, yet he says this, Romans 12, verse 15. He says, in effect, identify yourself with people. He says, rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that weep. I believe that in our lives is something which comes naturally. It's not natural to rejoice at the time that others are weeping. We weep with them. So it's the seasonal nature of things. There is a time to weep and a time to laugh. So this is the first thought then that Solomon brings to us in giving us instructions of how to live in the light of this travail that God has given to men. There is a benefit in sorrow, and it's better than trying to drown your sorrows in the raucous laughter of the banqueting house. Now in verses 7 to 10 of Ecclesiastes chapter 7, he turns to the benefits of something else. The benefits of patience and contentment. Verse 7, not very easy to understand this verse. Surely oppression maketh a wise man mad. He's speaking, I believe, of the bad effect on even a wise man when he suddenly finds himself in a place of power. Power is delivered into his hand, and he finds himself able to oppress others. It twists his mind, even a wise man. Power corrupts. That's the thought he's bringing in here. It's better to have a little, to be content, and to be patient to the end of a thing. The middle of verse 7, a gift destroyeth the heart. The word is a bribe. A bribe. Receiving a bribe, it leads to corruption. It's far better to be content, far better to be patient than to desire this position of power and to desire this position of money. Verse 8. Better is the end of a thing. It's better to be patient to the end than the beginning thereof. Oh, it looks good in the beginning to be raised to this place of power. It looks good to have this sum of money given to you. But it will lead to corruption, he says. It's better to wait the end of a thing in God's time than the beginning thereof. And the patient in spirit, the one that is prepared to wait, is better than the one who finds himself in a position of being proud in spirit because of that place that he's been given in society. Verse 9, another example of patience. Be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of fools. Well, that doesn't need any explaining. That's perfectly simple. Be not angry. The Apostle Paul says as much in Ephesians chapter 5. Do away with all these things, wrath and anger. They should have no place in our lives. So patience is to be exercised, even though we may have cause to be angry. There is, I believe, no such thing in the life of any believer as righteous anger. Verse 10. Now this is very topical. Say not thou, what is the cause that the former days were better than these? How do we express this today? The good old days. That's the thought here. Oh, we remember the good old days, the things that we enjoyed in those days. But now look at our miserable lot that we've got today. What does Solomon say? Thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this. He says, don't complain about the present and look back and say, oh, the blessings that we enjoyed in time past in the good old days. He says, look, in effect, remember this, that man is prone to remember the good things and to forget the things which are bad. This is exactly what Israel did. Numbers 11 and verse 5. Numbers chapter 11. Verse 4. And the mixed multitude that was among them, this is the people of Israel who had come out of Egypt now, and the mixed multitude had come out with them. The mixed multitude that was among them fell a-lusting. And the children of Israel also wept again and said, who shall give us flesh to eat? We remember, there they are, the good old days, we remember them. The fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic, but now our soul is dried away. There is nothing at all beside this manna before our eyes, that manna that had come down from heaven. Oh, they remembered all the blessings of Egypt, but they forgot all the hard bondage and all the trouble that they'd had under the Egyptian taskmasters. So they were prone to forget the evil and to remember the good. So Solomon says, say not thou what is the cause that the former days were better than these. Thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this. So he shows then the benefits of patience and contentment in this life. Verse 11. Now from chapter 7, verse 11, on to chapter 10 and verse 15, we come to what we would have expected from this man Solomon, a man who had been given wisdom above any other man. We would expect that he would dwell largely upon the benefits of and the application of wisdom to the affairs of this life. Now the word wisdom as a conception, I'm not talking about the word wise when it says a wise man, but the idea of wisdom as a conception. This word has not been used by Solomon for 4.5 chapters of this book. And now all of a sudden he begins to use it again He's speaking about wisdom now, and it comes 17 times toward the end of the book. So he's on this subject of wisdom. And he begins to show that wisdom is better than anything else that we can possess. Verse 11. Wisdom is good with an inheritance. Probably this is meant to imply as good as an inheritance. Not good with an inheritance. It is good with it. If you've got wisdom and money, you can use your money wisely. There is sense in that, but he's not actually saying that here. Wisdom is as good as an inheritance. Yea, it is better. There is an advantage to those that see the sun. Verse 12:4, wisdom is a defense. Now that word defense is the word shadow. And it means a great deal to anybody living in a hot country to have a shadow or a shade over their head. Wisdom's as good as that. It's as good as a shadow. And money as a shadow. But wisdom is better when it's associated with knowledge. The excellency of knowledge is that wisdom giveth life to them that have it. Now there comes a time when money may deliver you from death. But there's another time when money may not, but wisdom will. So he's beginning to contrast then wisdom and money. Verse 19. Wisdom strengtheneth the wise more than 10 mighty men which are in a fortress. Wisdom's far better on your side than 10 mighty men in a fortress. That's what he's saying here. More likely to affect deliverance. Chapter 9, verses 14 and 15. He gives us an example of this. There was a little city, and a few men within it. And there came a great king against it, and besieged it, and built great bulwarks against it. Now what were they going to do? Were they going to offer this great king with his army money? Well, he could come and take it at his own will. What's the good of money in a situation like this? Verse 15, now there was found in it, not a rich wise man, but a poor wise man. And he by his wisdom, not by his money, but he by his wisdom delivered the city. Wisdom is better than money here. So here it is, a poor wise man. And you'll note this, that no man remembered that same poor man. It wasn't that he became rich afterwards, they all forgot about him. He remained poor. A poor wise man, but he had wisdom, and that was better than all the money they could have given to him. He delivered the city as a result of his wisdom. So here Solomon is given then these benefits of wisdom and showing how much better wisdom is than anything you might like to name in this life. Now he begins to apply this wisdom to the things of life, and he applies it first of all to the work of God. How can we be wise with respect to what God is doing? Well, verse 13 of chapter 7 of Ecclesiastes. He says, consider the work of God, for who can make that straight which he hath made crooked? Now, this is what wisdom recognizes, first of all, that man can't alter what God is doing. It's a wise man that recognizes that. He can't alter what God is doing. He shouldn't want to, of course, alter it, but he can't alter it. Verse 14, he can't understand what God is doing, not completely. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. Solomon is saying here, look, just accept things as they come. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider why you're going through this trial. God also has set the one over against the other to the end. Now this is the reason that man should find out nothing after him. The ways of God are higher than the ways of man, and man cannot understand always what God is doing. So man is to be, then, a person who recognizes that he cannot alter the ways of God or alter the works of God, and he cannot fully enter yet into an understanding of what God is doing. Now Solomon gives an example of this in verse 15. All things have I seen in the days of my vanity. There is a just man that perishes by reason of his righteousness. Now there's a strange thing. You would have thought that this man, because he was righteous, why, he would have been blessed of God. But no, says Solomon, I can't understand this. God allows him to perish, and it's by reason of his righteousness. And on the other hand, there's a wicked man that prolongs his life by reason of his wickedness. Well, here's one of the ways in which we cannot understand exactly what God is doing. He allows such things to take place. We don't know what's in the mind of God, says Solomon. So what do? We accept it. We accept it. We accept the balance. In the day of prosperity, we rejoice. God is blessing us. In the day of adversity, we consider God has set the one over the other, that there might be a balance in life. Chapter 8 and verse 14, he brings the subject up again. There is a vanity which is done upon the earth, that there be just men unto whom it happeneth according to the work of the wicked. They're being dealt with as though they're wicked men, but they're just really. Again, there be wicked men to whom it happeneth according to the work of the righteous. Here's one of these transitory things, one of these passing things, one of these things which is not permanent. I can't understand it, says Solomon. And so in verse 17, this is where it leads him to. I'm in chapter 8. Then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun, because though a man labour to seek it out, and goodness knows, Solomon set himself this task, to labour to seek out all that God is doing under the sun. Because though a man labour to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, Father, though a wise man, and Solomon was the wisest, though a wise man think to know it, yet shall he not be able to find it. Chapter 7 and verse 23. All this have I proved by wisdom. I said I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? Even Solomon in all his wisdom has to confess this, that wisdom led him to know this, that he could not find out all that God was doing in this creation. So this leads him then to recognize that God is balancing things out, and that one should recognize this and live in the light of it. Therefore, says Solomon, man should live a balanced life between the two extremes. And now we come to a very difficult passage in Ecclesiastes. Look at verse 14. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider. God has set the one over against the other. There is a balance. Now that is the thought that is being carried through these next verses. But how to apply it is not so obvious. First of all, verse 20. Let man, first of all, says Solomon, recognize what he is. There is not a just man upon earth that doeth good and sinneth not. We're all sinners, says Solomon, and it's best for us to start from here. Recognize that we're sinners. Now, we must remember that Ecclesiastes, that Solomon knew nothing of what Paul was going to write later on in Romans chapter 6 about a deliverance from sin, being dead to sin and alive unto God. Solomon, as far as we know, knew nothing of that deliverance. And so he says it's best to recognize that you're a sinner in this life. Recognize that that's the sort of person that you are. You are prone to sin. Recognize that. But keep this thing in its right perspective. Keep a balanced life. Keep a balanced view of life on these things. Verse 17. Although you are a sinner, be not overmuch wicked, neither be thou foolish. Well, we can understand that. Although you're a sinner, don't make an excuse for going to extremes. Don't do that. But here's the rub. Verse 16. Here's the difficult part, which no commentator has really explained, to my satisfaction at least. Be not righteous overmuch. What does that mean? How can we be overmuch righteous? Well, one wouldn't have thought that it was possible. You've got to keep the idea in your mind that what Solomon knew at this time, and that he's trying to present to us a balanced life, a recognition that we're sinners, not too righteous, not too wicked, just in the middle, as it were, here. God has set the one over against the other. Now, what does this overmuch righteousness mean? Well, some people have suggested that it's rather like that Pharisaical righteousness practiced by those men in the New Testament, whereby they were scrupulous about things. Well, that may be so, They were righteous in a certain way, but it, when you boiled it all down, it wasn't really a true kind of righteousness. You remember what the Apostle Paul said about Israel? He said, this nation of Israel, he said, they've got a zeal of God, a zeal, but it's not according to knowledge. Because they've made a great mistake concerning righteousness. They've gone about not to establish his righteousness, they've gone about to establish their own righteousness. Now that may be behind this passage. Or it may be something else. It may be that here is a zeal for righteousness, but without discretion. I don't know whether you've ever met those Christians. They seem to look for martyrdom. They seek martyrdom. They're not prepared to wait God's turn if he calls them to go through martyrdom. They seek it. Rather like one man going out against an evil army on his own. Well, it may be a righteous act, but it's also a very foolish act. There is a time when discretion is the better part of valour. And so that may be what is here implied. And Solomon says in effect, don't go beyond what God requires of you. Be sensible, be balanced about this idea of righteousness. Recognise that you're a sinner, but don't be over wicked, don't be over righteous. Just take this middle course. And of course he hangs it upon verse 15. The just man that perishes by reason of his righteousness. And he says in effect, be not righteous overmuch therefore, neither make thyself over wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Why do this? Well, I don't know whether this satisfies you. I must confess, it doesn't completely satisfy me. But it's the best answer that I have at the tip of my tongue at the moment. Now Solomon turns then from the works of God, which he cannot understand, to the works of man. And he begins to inquire into these extremes. The extremes of folly. Chapter 7, verses 25 to 29. And the extremes of wisdom. Chapter 8, verse 1 onwards. He considers in these verses, verse 25 of chapter 7, I applied mine heart to know, and to search, and to seek out wisdom, and the reason of things, and to know the wickedness of folly, the extremes of folly. That's what I'm looking for. Even of foolishness and madness. And Solomon, we know the conclusion he's going to come to. He says, the highest instance of folly that I saw was this. Verse 26, I find more bitter than death, not the woman, don't stop there, that would be terrible, not the woman, but the woman whose heart is snares and nets and her hands as bands. That kind of woman, when Solomon was associated with enough of them, all he knew, that is the highest instance of folly, to be taken in by a woman. It's a strange thing that a man who is otherwise sensible can fall into the hands of such a woman as this, whose heart is snares and nets, and he can become putty in her hands. Solomon was a man like that. We read that these wives of strange countries that he married, or that were his concubines, they turned his heart away from God. And that they caused idolatry to take place in Israel. Solomon was like putty in their hands. He says, the middle of verse 26, whoso pleases God shall escape from her. Well, Solomon had evidently not pleased God. He disobeyed the commandment of going outside Israel and marrying outside for a start. He'd not pleased God. Here is he taken by, he said, and it's my bitter experience that I have been taken by such as these. The sinner, the one who habitually sins, shall be taken by her. Whoso pleases God shall escape from her. There are the two thoughts there. Now in verses 27 and 28, he looks round upon mankind and he begins to see just how rare it is to come across a true man or a true woman. Verse 27, behold, this have I found, saith the preacher, counting one by one. I've not looked upon them generally, I've looked upon them as individuals and I've examined them one by one to find out the account. And I'm still looking, he says, which yet my soul seeketh. But I find not. One true man among a thousand have I found, but a woman among all those I have not found. Now, as I've said before, of course, this means that the lady is more rare and is perhaps worth more because he didn't find one, you see. But here it is, Solomon's terrible experience with mankind. And then in verse 29, he sums it all up. He says, look, this is one thing I have found, that God has made man upright, harking back to the way that Adam was made. God has made him like this, but they have sought out many inventions. Notice this. They've sought them out. It's not that God has put them in the world and they've come across them by accident. They've looked for them. They've sought them out. Many inventions. And that terrible passage in Romans chapter 1, where Paul is giving us a great list of the sins of mankind. One of the things that he says in Romans 1 verse 30 is this, inventors of evil things. Inventors. They are the ones that brought it about. These things never even entered my mind, says God. So here they are, inventions. Interesting to note that this word invention is used of war. In 2 Chronicles 26, 15, it's the word translated engines. In the days of Uzziah, certain crafty men, certain cunning men, made these that they called engines. And the object of these engines were to cast stones at great distances and to fire arrows. And as a result of this, Uzziah won his battles. He strengthened himself because of the inventions of these men. And then what did he do, having become strong? He went into the temple of the Lord and he tried to do what only Christ can do. He tried to be the king priest. And so God had to strike him with leprosy. So here it is, they have sought out many inventions. Now he turns away from folly, chapter 8 and verse 1. And he begins to deal now with wisdom and the application of wisdom to life. Who is it the wise man? And who knoweth the interpretation of things? Who knows the explanation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face to shine. I wonder if he has in mind here the fact that sometimes when sin is practiced, it can be seen on the face of a man. Maybe. Debauchery can be seen on the face of a man. So can wisdom. Wisdom makes his face to shine, and the hardness of his face, not the boldness, the hardness or the ruggedness of his face shall be changed. That's what wisdom does. It even makes a difference to a person's outward appearance, his face. Now these next verses, I suppose I keep saying this, but I must say it, that these verses are difficult to follow. And instead of going through them verse by verse, I want to just pick out a verse here and there and to try and show you the way that this man is thinking. Let's start with chapter 8 and verse 17. This is a thought that's in the back of his mind as he begins to turn these things over. We've got to remember, of course, that we're dealing here with the Hebrew language and the Hebrew idiom, and it's been translated into English for us. And the Authorized Version translators, and every translator since, has had a difficulty in bringing these things out, actually what is being said. So you can imagine if they've had a difficulty, then I'm likely to have the same kind of difficulty here. But we'll pick these thoughts out and see how his mind is working. Verse 17. Then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Here's the thought in the back of his mind. The work of God is past finding out. Verse 14. Sometimes that work of God appears to be unjust. There is a vanity which is done upon the earth, that there be just men unto whom it happeneth according to the work of the wicked, and vice versa. So sometimes these ways of God are unjust. Now because of this, man takes advantage of it. Chapter 8 and verse 11. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. They take advantage of this unequal idea of justice. He is a wicked man. He prolongs his life by his wickedness. So other people take advantage of this. Because God doesn't strike him down immediately, man takes advantage of this. Well, there's coming an age, the great age for which the people of Israel were looking forward to, the millennium, the golden age. And of that age we read that every man shall die for his own iniquity. Then there will be judgment every day But now, the experience is not that. So men take advantage of it. But they don't act wisely in this, says Solomon. Oh, it looks as though they're acting wisely, but they don't. Verse 12 of chapter 8. Though a sinner do evil 100 times, and his days be prolonged, yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before him. But it shall not be well with the wicked. It will not be well with him. He may think it's going to be, but it will not. Solomon is saying in effect here, if the work of God is past finding out, if you don't really know what God is doing, dare you do anything else than fear before him. The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, said Proverbs, and this is the conclusion this man's going to come to. The whole duty of man, he says, at the end of this book, is to fear God and keep his commandments. Whatever things may appear around us, however much the wicked may seem to prosper, this is what I counsel you to do. Fear God and keep his commandments. And this is because, although Solomon can't really see clearly the idea of resurrection yet, he can see that there's going to be a judgment after death. And the wise man recognizes this. Chapter 8, verse 5. Whoso keepeth the commandment shall feel no evil thing, and a wise man's heart discerneth both time and judgment. Perhaps we put the two thoughts together. There is a time for judgment. That time isn't yet, but the wise man recognizes that it's coming. So what is the lot of man in the light of this? Chapter 8, verse 6. Because to every purpose there is a time and judgment, because there's a waiting time, therefore the misery of man is great upon him. You see, he doesn't see the wicked man judged for his sins. And so, obviously, this bears down on him like a great burden. The misery of man is great because this time of judgment is not yet. But none will prevent it, he says in verse 8. There is no man that has power over the spirit to retain the spirit. When God says finish, the spirit returns to God who gave it. Nobody can stop death. It's inevitable. Neither has he power in the day of death. There is no discharge in that war. Nobody's going to get away with it. Neither shall wickedness deliver those that are given to it. Wickedness may seem now in this present life to prolong the days of those who are wicked. But when death comes and when the time of judgment comes, wickedness will not prevail then. It will not deliver those that are given to it. So then he sums up and he says it is better. It will be well with those that fear God. Verse 12. Though a sinner do evil 100 times and his days be prolonged, yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before him. Now very quickly, chapter 9. In verses 1 to 3, he's speaking of the fact that there's no distinction made, apparently, between the wicked and the just. And the one thing which shows that there's no distinction as far as this life is concerned is the fact that there's one event. Verse 2. All things come alike to all. There is one event to the righteous and to the wicked. But, says Solomon, don't despair about this. Don't desire that time come. Don't desire the day of death. Make the most of life. Chapter 9, verses 4 to 10. For to him that is joined to all the living, there is hope. That's a well-known expression. Where there's life, there's hope. And he says it doesn't matter what sort of a person you are. Are you like a living dog, verse 4? Well, if you're a living dog, that's better than a dead lion. So make the most of this life. You see, the dog, for the Israelite, was the most despised creature. So much so that they gave the name later on to the Gentiles. Dogs. But the lion was a greatly admired creature, the lion of Judah. But here it is. What's the difference between a dead lion and a living dog? Well, the living dog is better. So, he says, make the most of this life. It's better to be alive than to be dead. Verse 11. Expect nothing out of life, and you will not be disappointed. This is a thought here. I turned again. I looked in another direction. And saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, Now, if we're looking at justice as we understand it, the man who runs fastest ought to win the race, but he doesn't. This is another evidence of not being able to understand what God is doing quite. The race is not to the swift, nor is the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favour to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. From man's point of view, and let's keep this straight, from man's point of view, all is chance. That's how he looks at things, and you know that's exactly how an ungodly person does look at things. They talk about luck. A person being either lucky or unlucky. And that's the only way they can see things. And if you're looking at it purely from man's point of view, it is simply chance, the whole thing. But we know, and Solomon knew, that God was working behind the scenes, and it's only because we can't exactly see what he's doing that things look in this particular way. So just to close then, this meeting, he gives an example of this chance. He's mentioned in verse 11 that the battle is not to the strong, neither is bread to the wise. So he's going to give an example. Verse 13, chapter 9. This wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and it seemed great unto me. There was a little city, and few men within it, and there came a great king against it, and besieged it, and built great bulwarks against it. Here was an example of a battle. Was it to the strong? No. Because a poor wise man, we read, delivered this city. The battle was not to the strong. It was to the poor wise man. But what did the poor wise man get out of it? Well, they didn't remember him. He got nothing out of it. There was not bread to the wise. So he gives these examples there. Now, in the next verses, he goes on to show that wisdom is, verse 16, better than strength. Verse 18, it's better than the weapons of war. Chapter 10, verse 2, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. And now this idea of wisdom is beginning to dwell on his mind, and he's beginning to think of that young man who has been raised up to take his place. Remember that Solomon at this time is an old man. He's thinking of Rehoboam, the man that's going to sit on his throne. And he's beginning to give his instructions in the light of this man. And eventually when he gets to chapter 12, he's going to say this. And I think he's saying it basically to his son. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, before these terrible days of old age begin to come upon you, and you say, I have no pleasure in them. So he's beginning now in these verses to lead to his own son, Rehoboam, and to give him instruction as to what he ought to do in life. Now we'll continue that when we meet together again around this subject.